listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to another edition of The Corbett Report. I'm your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you, as always, from the sunny climes of Western Japan, here in October of 2024, with episode 467 of The Corbett Report podcast, Naming Names and Connecting Dots in the Globalist Agenda. Yes, if you are looking for names to be named and organizations to be singled out and documents to be cited, boy, have you come to the right place. I hope you have your pen and paper ready with you today, class, because there is going to be, as usual, a lot of information to go through and a lot of specific citations, which, if you happen to miss upon hearing or viewing for the first time, of course, you can get by going to today's episode at CorbettReport.com/naming-names. And there you will be able to find all of the documentation in the show notes for today's data dump. And today we're going to turn, well, back to that same ICS, International Crisis Summit Conference, that I hope you know by now I attended at the end of last month in Tokyo. And I hope you know that at the very least because of episode 466, the previous edition of the Corbett Report podcast on Japan Rising, where I presented a number of speeches and snippets from those ICS proceedings, specifically in that case surrounding the release, the unleashing, the dropping of the third atomic bomb of the Replicon vaccines upon the Japanese people, which is underway. And I will have more to say about that in the future, you have no doubt. But today, I'm going to talk about a different aspect of, well, one of the many themes that came up at the International Crisis Summit, which was not simply and solely about the Replicon vaccine. Today, we're going to listen to the lecture that was delivered at the Japanese Diet by Dr. Meryl Nass, who you will remember as my co-host on the regular WHO update series that we did in the lead-up to the 77th World Health Assembly and the big WHO IHR amendments slash pandemic treaty negotiations and all of that that took place earlier this year. You know, I was doing a regular update series with Meryl Nass on that subject. Well, since the WHA and all of the things that happened at that World Health Assembly, as I hope you know, Dr. Nass has continued on with her work and her activism and her efforts, but has branched out, not just focusing solely on the World Health Organization, but now looking at the broader globalist agenda. And she is still continuing to do that through her website and her organization, Door to Freedom, at doortofreedom.org. I hope you are paying attention to it, where recently she has been documenting and detailing the food aspect of this globalist agenda and the attack on food and agriculture that you might have, of course, seen in that two-day symposium that Door to Freedom recently put on with Children's Health Defense on attack on food and farmers and how to fight back. And again, I hope you have at least seen that because, of course, you remember my Solutions Watch, in which I presented my presentation to that symposium on the future of food is ours to decide. Again, all of the links to all of this information will be in the show notes in case you happen to miss it. But today we're going to be talking about Dr. Nass's presentation at the ICS in Tokyo, where she was looking at this globalist agenda and the broader sort of the UN umbrella under which it is operating and starting to name some of the names and get into some of the facts, dates, details, and source documents. So there is a lot of information in this presentation we are about to watch, and I am gratified to note that, as Dr. Nass confided in me, as she got the lead on Maurice Strong and really found out about Maurice Strong and his connections into so much of this from my previous work on Strong. For example, how big oil steers the environmental movement, which was a clip, an excerpt from Why Big Oil Conquered the World. My interview with Elaine Dewar on Maurice Strong's Cloak of Green, and meet Maurice Strong, globalist, oligarch, environmentalist. I have talked about Maurice Strong quite a bit over the years, so all of those will be linked up in case you happen to have missed that. But Dr. Nass picked up that ball and ran with it and started uncovering aspects and updates to this agenda, the post-Strong even agenda, that I hadn't picked up on myself. So I want to present this presentation to you for your edification. In the show notes, I will have a link to the actual PowerPoint that she was using, so you can download it and you will have those slides and you will be able to follow each of the links that she has in here. But let's just get straight into the presentation where she starts naming the names, so get your pen and paper ready. And yes, in advance, sorry, this is not the highest quality pro shot footage. I was just doing the best that I could with the limited rig setup I had at the time. But it is viewable and it is listenable, so here we go, straight into Dr. Nass's presentation.
Anyway, I'm honored and thrilled to be here and to be among so many friends. And to be among the Japanese people who are our brothers and sisters in this struggle of the people of the world against a small group of elites who think they should be in charge of us. Okay, I'm gonna come down here. So it turned out that in fact we weren't at the beginning of something, but we were at the end of something. And actually, there's been a plan in place for a minimum of 50 years to bring us to a culmination which would lead to centralization of power and collecting our resources for a small group of wealthy individuals. And it turned out, as I studied this more, that conferences and treaties conducted by the UN and its agencies were central to this program. And there were a few key individuals we can identify who were involved. And the Millennium Development Goals, the Sustainable Development Goals, all of this were part of this same program. And as you look back for over 50 years, you can see these different policies and narratives snapping into piece, like puzzle pieces, each building on the others to create, to bring us to where we are today in terms of climate, in terms of 15-minute cities, population control, pandemics, etc. Next slide. So is the future as scary as they say? Well, that's a good question. It's really a class war. I mean, we've always had class wars. We just haven't been allowed to talk about them for a long time. But perhaps most wars are class wars. And of course, the induction of anxiety, fear, confusion, and shame. Shame is really important because all our children have been subjected to this nonsense that it's their fault that the planet is dying, and it's because of them, and they have to do better, and therefore they must comply. And then I think about 25 years ago, the idea entered this realm that pandemics, bioterrorism, and vaccinations could be part of this theme that they already had about environmental degradation and climate being the big issues that with which they could control us. So once they added these, they had access to our bodies with the injections, as well as more reasons to fear and create new existential threats. Next slide. Okay, so devilishly clever plan, as you already know. These are pictures of some of the key individuals involved. I'll just mention that's Gro Harlem Brundtland on the left. She was 3 times Prime Minister of Norway. Norway, of course, has the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, which is a target for globalism and contributes to many of their programs. Bill Gates, Kissinger, and von der Leyen. Fauci, of course. This guy, hardly anyone knows, is, what's his name? Maurice Strong, Canadian, friend of David Rockefeller's, who almost single-handedly carried this whole narrative along for 40 years and dragged the planet with him, and Jeremy Farrar. These were the plans. They had great theories, you know, things that everyone could agree with. Yes, the planet is being degraded by pollution. Maybe there are too many people. We're going to run out of resources. The climate, you know, first it was, of course, global warming, but sometimes it gets colder. So we'll just call it climate change. And no matter how it changes, we're still, you know, we've got the verbiage right. They didn't talk much about how national sovereignty was to be replaced by global governance, but that's where we have been going for 50 years. And that is probably why the UN was formed in the first place. And remember, it was the Rockefellers who donated the money to build the UN on the East River in New York. Next slide. This is the first, so that guy Maurice Strong was the Secretary General of this conference, as well as the Secretary General of the 1992 Rio Conference. He spent 4 years getting this conference together, and it was the first environmental conference of the UN. And so he had to sort of create the whole infrastructure, work with people. He was a fabulous networker, and he was interested in changing habitats, changing our cities and towns, making sure that countries who took money and help had to go along with the program, and family planning, population control, which has never been popular with many countries. So he worked on this, and there were failures. You know, not everybody went along. Yes, limits to growth had just been published. He knew who his friends and enemies were, but he kept working the program. Next slide. Okay, this is Richard Gardner, who was writing in the Council on Foreign Relations journal 51 years ago. He was telling us what the plan was then. Global governance. Countries would, in fact, be subject to international standards and rules and regulations that they'd never had to deal with before. And the international agencies would gain more power over them. Next slide. This is Maurice Strong. These are all the different jobs he held. So in 72, he did the first environment conference. In 75, he founded the UN Environmental Program, which exists today and was its first head. Then he moved on to the Brundtland Commission, which created the idea of sustainable development. In 1992, he was again the Secretary General of the World's Environment Conference, but this time it was much more successful. He figured out how to finesse everything, the Rio Earth Summit, and even 20 years later, he was senior advisor to the next Secretary General of the UN Conference on Sustainable Development in 2012. 40 years of this. He was a board member of the World Economic Forum. He was Under Secretary General of the whole UN. He was a special advisor to the UN Secretary General, advisor to the President of the World Bank. He was running the Oil for Food program. He got in trouble there. They said he was stealing some money, and he wound up sitting and didn't steal anything, but he wound up moving to China for his last years. He died in 2015. Next slide. This lady, three times Prime Minister of Norway, then she goes and becomes, after she does the Brundtland Commission and comes up with sustainable development and helps building this narrative, she becomes the head of the World Health Organization. She helped to create the international health regulations that we're just amending now. So she had at that point given the Director General more power. It was building to this. She was involved with the Tobacco Framework Convention, which also served as model for things going forward. She was the UN's special envoy on climate change. She was one of the founders of this group, the Elders, which are former heads of state that try to, advise the world on what it should be doing. She was then put into the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, which is telling countries how they have to prepare for bioterrorism and pandemics, along with Farrar and Fauci, a very small number of people in that group. And vice chair of the UN Foundation. She's still alive, about 85 years old now, still working for the globalists. Next slide. What happened at that Rio Earth Summit in 92 that was so successful? They got into the greenhouse gas business. You know, that they decided they were going to focus on greenhouse gases. They claimed they weren't going to reduce food production. Of course, that came later. And they wanted sustainable development. Next slide. And Agenda 21. Next slide. Thank you. Okay, the Convention on Biological Diversity. There's another narrative that's very important to them. I'll show you why in a minute. Also originated from this conference. And from this Biological Diversity Convention came the Cartagena Protocol on Biosafety, which actually may help us. I mentioned it the other day, because it is saying that, look, genetically modified living organisms may actually interfere with biodiversity, may kill off species, and that is not supposed to happen. So we should remember this and use it in our fight. The Nagoya Protocol, interestingly, which is about benefits that nations will get from sharing their organisms, is the foundation for the benefit sharing and creating of a library of pandemic pathogens that the WHO was trying to do over the last couple of years. So the whole thing is, if your nation gives biological warfare agents to the WHO, pharma will pay you based on this Nagoya Protocol. So see how the pieces are snapping into place, they create this, and then they come back a few years later with the bioterrorism library. They couldn't get it at the WHO, so the countries did not go along with this bioterrorism agent library. And so what's happening? They've simply moved it over to the Convention on Biological Diversity, the next iteration is coming up next month in October. And they're going to be discussing this benefit sharing there. So they've been working on that. So this is what they do. Can't get it through this group of negotiators. Let's take it to these guys over here and put in the people we want. Next slide. Okay, so in 2000, they had the UN Millennium Declaration, which started the Millennium Development Goals, which ran from 2002 to 2015. And then in 2015, they said, look how good we did. We lifted 1 billion people out of poverty. This is fabulous. We're great. We're going to keep doing it. And what they didn't tell you is that that was because 800 million people had been lifted out of poverty in China and had nothing to do with the Millennium Development Goals. You know, it was because the West was investing in China, and China was expanding. But then, so then they created, next slide please, the Sustainable Development Goals, which started in 2015 and were supposed to end in 2030. They added more goals, but what they've admitted now is that they've gone backwards since 2015. They haven't accomplished anything. I mean, they've accomplished a lot of solar farms, but, you know, in terms of poverty, hunger, etc., there's more of that than there was before. But now, the UN and the WHO are saying, my God, we've got to turbocharge the Sustainable Development Goals because they exist. You know, we made them, we created them, and we've got to achieve them, whatever it takes. And that's what the Pact for the Future was about, which was adopted last week on Sunday at the UN. It was a loosely written document, so there were very few specifics. We don't know exactly how they're gonna turbocharge this, but they want a lot of money, and they wanna move forward very fast, presumably before everybody figures out what's going on. But there may be other reasons. Next slide. The Paris Agreement of 2015 is where they actually came up with this 1.5 degrees centigrade that we can't exceed. But if we do exceed it, because we were already at about 1.1 degree or 1.2 degrees over the temperature at the start of the industrial age. So we only had this tiny, tiny little bit to go before we arrived at 1.5 degrees. And they said maybe 2 degrees. Well, we can't possibly go over 2 degrees, or, you know, the oceans will boil. which is, you know, whatever. The United States never ratified this, although we did ratify the 1992 agreement, and this takes its authority from that 92 framework on climate change. Next slide. All right, this was the biological diversity at their last meeting, and they're talking about managing 30% of the world's lands and waters by 2030. This is what's happening in the US. The Biden administration is designating these nature areas, and over time, the people who actually own the land or the water will be told how it has to be managed. Next slide. This is Natura 2000, and all of these colored areas have been designated as conservation areas. They're in that 30% by 2030, where somebody besides the owner is going to be deciding how they will be managed. Next slide. Next slide. This is the final slide. So this was the summit of the future that has been going on the last few days at the UN, where they tried to get this pact for the future accepted. Not surprisingly, it had to be watered down, but they did get something, and they will, the globalists and their flunkies at the UN and the UN system will claim they have consensus of the world to carry out whatever activities they wish, because there's a lot of flowery language in 60 pages. So they can claim anything, but you can see what they are claiming now. It's a once-in-a-generation opportunity to enhance cooperation and address gaps in global governance. That's language, you know, you can make anything of it. It reaffirms existing commitments. This is the turbocharging the Sustainable Development Goals. We love the UN Charter. We want a reinvigorated multilateral system better positioned to impact people's lives. In other words, we want the central world government to be able to issue orders more commonly. And so this is how it's happening. Now you know. I have to learn more about it, so do you. This is the stuff we have to stop. We need to get out of this system. We need to stamp on it. And we will have made great strides at unraveling ourselves from the noose that we're in at the moment. Thank you very much.
Once again, that is the always informative Dr. Meryl Nass of DoorToFreedom.org, and I hope you'll agree with me that was indeed a data dump of information, so let's unpack it a little, shall we? Because there's a lot to go through there, especially for people who are unfamiliar with that material. So, I think what we should do, as I say, I will be including the download for this presentation, all of the PowerPoint slides that Meryl was referring to there. I'll be including that as a download for you. So check the show notes at corbettreport.com/naming-names for this download, and you can follow along at home. But let's cut to the chase. So after the introduction, we get to the plan itself was devilishly clever, which notes that man himself was the planet's enemy, with shame leading to compliance, which is a very astute observation that is documentable. Specifically, you will probably know by now, because I've pointed to it many times, but, well, let's point to it again. This infamous passage from the First Global Revolution, which, for people who don't know, this was a Club of Rome report that was issued in 1991, I want to say. I believe it was 1991, which was officially authored by Alexander King and Bertrand Schneider. But involved a group effort of a number of different people talking about the impending problems that we all see taking place on the globe and what can be done about them. Well, I'm sure you can imagine what their solutions to that might be, but you don't have to imagine it or take my word for it. You can go read it for yourself. And I always take the opportunity to cite the final passage of chapter 5 of this book. In this edition, it's page 102. Again, it will be linked in the show notes, so you can go and read it for yourself. But I always cite this passage, "The common enemy of humanity is man," in which the globalists write in their own words, "In searching for a new enemy to unite us," which is a phrase that we could unpack for many hours just by itself, "in searching for a new enemy to unite us, we suggested that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill." Etc. You know, fill in the blanks. "In their totality and in their interactions, these phenomena constitute a common threat which demands the solidarity of all peoples. But in designating them as the enemy, we fall into the trap, about which we have already warned, namely mistaking symptoms for causes. All these dangers are caused by human intervention, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself." So, yes, you will see that this phrase that Merrill picks out here is documentable. Man himself was the planet's enemy, with shame leading to compliance. Yes, they literally write this in their own words. Humanity had to curb its destructive way of life, and ultimately the entire world was going to be limited based on, of course, human overconsumption, human raping of the planet's natural resources, etc., which is a narrative that, again, should be familiar to people who have been keeping their eyes on the actual pronouncements of the globalists, specifically documents like The Limits to Growth, which was, again, the Club of Rome, issued this report based on a project on the predicament of mankind, as they put it, which was, for people who don't know, it was based on this simulation, this computer simulation that was created back in 1972 when computer simulations were still, wow, look at this whiz-bang technology we have to predict the future. And they fed all of this data into an MIT database, and what results from it? Oh, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. The entire world is going to be completely depleted and deprived. People are going to be mass starving, and there's going to be pandemonium on the streets by the year 2000 or so. So what we need is, and of course, all the typical globalist solutions. Now, of course, it needs not be said, but I will state it for the record. This was complete pseudoscientific claptrap based on garbage in, garbage out, that absolutely does not stand up. And for people who want that elaborated in greater detail, boy, do I have a resource for you, specifically episode 77 of the Questions for Corbett series on Are There Limits to Growth? And spoiler, the answer is actually a surprising no, not really. And in order to understand that answer, you'll have to go through that episode. But the long story short is that The Limits to Growth, specifically, that report was total pseudoscientific nonsense claptrap and does not deserve the veneration that it has achieved over decades of globalist propaganda. But, well, we know why they are venerating it, precisely because it is the convenient way to arrive at their pre-made solutions, such as people being pitted against each other, cultures being diluted through attacks on traditional values and through mass immigration, seemingly truthful narratives created about pollution and diversity loss, environmental degradation, climate pandemics. Yes, all of these problems that they can point to that, what's the problem? Humans! So we need to control and ultimately get rid of humans. Yes, so the story is twisted and used to attack our way of life and our standard of living, national sovereignty to be replaced by global governance. Pieces have been put in place step by step. Well, let's explain how. So, for example, and there are many things that we can point to on this journey, but one example that was quite significant was the United Nations Conference on the Human Environment, which was held in Stockholm in 1972. And again, I hope you are familiar with this conference, not from all of the globalist propaganda that has proceeded from it over the decades, but hopefully from my analysis and talk about this conference in Why Big Oil Conquered the World.
Now, for the first time in the history of man, an international movement is underway. The people of the nations and the nations of the world have joined together to find the answers. This building and the world's representatives hold the solution. We've seen what we've done to bring about the destruction of our Earth. Is it not the time now to cure the disease that we ourselves have created?
Yes, the cure for the disease of mankind, according to Rockefeller-funded propaganda featuring John D. Rockefeller III as an expert commentator, was to be found at the United Nations, whose headquarters had been so graciously donated by the Rockefeller family itself. And the first step toward discovering that cure was to organize the UN Conference on the Human Environment in Stockholm in 1972, the world's first international environmental conference.
For 11 days in June 1972, Stockholm was a magnet for everyone concerned with the environment. 1,200 official delegates from 113 nations were in Stockholm for the first international conference on the human environment. The meeting, first proposed to the United Nations by Sweden and approved by the General Assembly in 1968, attracted worldwide attention. In 4 short years, the topic of the human environment had gone from the back pages of newspapers to make headlines on page one.
And who better to oversee the conference and lay the institutional groundwork for this burgeoning, oligarch-supported movement than a consummate oil man?
The very fact that the conference began with 113 participating countries, with very high-level delegations from those countries, this in itself represented a very significant step forward, because this demonstrated more than anything else the real concern of the majority of countries in the world.
Yes, that United Nations Conference on the Human Environment, which took place in Stockholm in 1972. If you are interested in more about this conference, which really was an important milestone on the path towards globalist government, I suggest you do further check into Why Big Oil Conquered the World, specifically the transcript of that documentary, if nothing else, where you can get the links to the various resources that explain that conference and its ramifications in further detail, including that very bizarre Survival of Spaceship Earth documentary that was created in preparation for those UN festivities starring Hugh Downs and other such nonsense and tish-tosh. But here we are in Meryl's presentation, in which she points out the various, well, scary parts of this agenda, including, of course, the planning of human settlements, and of course the need for international cooperation. We know what that means, the undermining of national sovereignty. And of course, family planning programs. Yes, because they are definitely concerned with family planning in the globalist networks. If you want to know what that really means, well, translation from the globalese, it means sterilization. And if you want more on that, I would highly suggest you check into my fact check on polio vaccines, tetanus vaccines, and the Gates Foundation, where not only do I talk more about those plans and their fruition in various programs, but also the types of debunkings and fact checks that get made about them and the proper response to those. So there's a lot of information in there. But yes, long story short, when they're talking about family planning programs, etc., they're talking about sterilization of the human population, voluntary or otherwise. Anyway, Meryl has the link to the actual document, the actual UN report here. So I will include that as well in the show notes so that you can go there directly, or you can get it from that slide presentation and you can read through for yourself the report of the UN Conference on the Human Environment and check into it for yourself. But let's move on. Then Meryl talks about, in 1974, Richard Gardner wrote this CFR article presaging what was to come. He was a member of Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission, founded in 1973. And yes, this is a foreign affairs article from April of 1974 called The Hard Road to World Order. And if that title rings a bell, then ding, 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 you are paying attention. Good job. Because you will remember that that Hard Road to World Order, of course, was also referenced and became the subtitle of Patrick Wood's book on technocracy, The Hard Road to World Order, which I interviewed him about back in 2019, in interview 1433. And you will know that, for example, Patrick Wood points out that Richard Gardner's article was an important part in the founding of the technocratic ethos and mindset amongst the globalist elites in the Trilateral Commission and elsewhere. Long story short, for those who haven't read this article, The Hard Road to World Order posits that, oh no, woe be us, us poor globalists. People aren't falling for our globalist shtick about having a world federalism and charter review and world peace through world law anymore, and it's all falling apart. So what should we do if instant world government, charter review, and a greatly strengthened international court do not provide the answers? What hope for progress is there? The answer will not satisfy those who seek simple solutions to complex problems, but it comes down essentially to this. The hope for the foreseeable future lies not in building up a few ambitious central institutions of universal membership and general jurisdiction, as was envisaged at the end of the last war, but rather in the much more decentralized, disorderly and pragmatic process of inventing or adapting institutions of limited jurisdiction and selected membership to deal with specific problems on a case-by-case basis as the necessity for cooperation is perceived by the relevant nations. Such institutions of limited jurisdiction will have a better chance of doing what must be done to make a rule of law possible among nations. Blah, blah, blah. In other words, it will have to come from the bottom up rather than from the top down. We can't just impose our world order. It will have to come from the bottom up. So his article is about how to do that and the technocratic measures that must be implemented through various institutions. And as Merrill is pointing out, there's a lot of, well, very prescient language in here that really did set the tone for generations to come. The hopeful aspect, even as nations resist appeals for world government, the surrender of sovereignty, technological, economic, and political interests are forcing them to establish more and more far-reaching arrangements to manage their mutual independence. They'll be seeking new rules, will subject countries to an unprecedented degree of international surveillance over up to now sacrosanct domestic policies, such as farm price supports, again, the attack on food and farms, and international agencies will be given broad powers to promulgate and revise standards limiting air and ocean pollution. It's all for your good, guys, but we have to give them as much power as possible. Again, a link to the, this link to the article isn't working for me, but I will include a working link to the archived version of The Hard Road to World Order so you can read through the document for yourself. Moving right along, yes, we have more about Maurice Strong and his role in this. And again, for people who need more, I've already cited several things that I've done on him and his remarkable, unbelievable career that would make no sense from any perspective other than, oh, he was a made man from a young age because he happened to bump into David Rockefeller at the right time and managed to work as essentially his underling. So let's go on to the next part of this. As Merrill dug up, Dr. Gru Harlem Brundtland is an incredibly important figure in this story, and one that I've mentioned before, but I've never done the deep dive into, and I was even surprised to learn from Merrill that she's still alive. Is she still alive? Anyway, for those who don't know, this is Mama Norway, the most famous Norwegian politician slash UN chairwoman and all of this, who has had, again, a magical career with all sorts of connections to Bilderberg and other such globalist institutions and organizations. And it is in that respect, not the fact that she's beloved by the Norwegians, Mama Norway, they call her, presumably because she's one of the only Norwegians that people outside of Norway would have any chance of being able to name. And even then, how many people in the Corporate Report audience know Brundtland's name? Hopefully you do, because you've been paying attention to my work on this in the past. But anyway, yes, Dr. Gru Harlem Brundtland, who created something called Our Common Future, which was a publication released in 1987 by the World Commission on Environment and Development. And I've cited that particular work before, as has Patrick Wood in his work, because that document, Our Common Future, is the document from which we derive the concept and the term of sustainable development. And don't pull on the old fact checker trick. Well, actually, the words sustainable development have been used in conjunction before that. This is where the idea of sustainable development as we have received it today really comes from. So it is a document worth your time and attention, and plenty of links in here to various resources about the Brundtland Report, so you can read through for yourself and find out more about it. As I say, you will be familiar with it, at the very least, hopefully, from Patrick Wood's work on this report and what it was doing there in the 1980s to help cement this in the public consciousness. We did talk about it in our conversation on The Hard Road to World Order, but more in more depth, I talked about it in episode 322 of the Corbett Report podcast, What is Sustainable Development, which is a podcast I will commend to your attention because I think it is a valuable one. We all think we know what the words sustainable development mean, but do we really? Well, probably not, and certainly not if you're not familiar with documents such as the Brundtland Report and don't know people like Dr. Gru Harlem Brundtland and who she is and who she's connected into. So in episode 322, I did talk to Patrick Wood about this, and I did have some comments about the Brundtland Report. So we've had the big overview of what this agenda is, and now we're narrowing down on some of the core documents and details about the who, what, where, when, why. So let's turn to some of those core documents that Patrick Wood was mentioning there. Firstly, where did this come from? Where did sustainable development, capital S, capital D, as a concept really emerge from? Well, it's been around since the 1970s, but it was really formalized, as Patrick Wood pointed out there, by the Brundtland Commission, more formally known as the United Nations World Commission on Environment and Development, chaired by Gru Harlem Brundtland, and one of the members on that commission, no surprise to anyone in the audience who's been paying attention to my work on these issues, of course, was Maurice Strong. But that commission, of course, did come out with its final report in 1987 called Our Common Future, and we don't have to speculate about what was in that report. You can turn to undocuments.net, un-documents.net, where you can read the report itself. And specifically, Section 3 is headlined Sustainable Development. And this was the formalization and the codification of our modern understanding of this term. So let's read a little bit from this document, Section 3-27. Humanity has the ability to make development sustainable to ensure that it meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. The concept of sustainable development does imply limits. Not absolute limits, but limitations imposed by the present state of technology and social organization on environmental resources and by the ability of the biosphere to absorb the effects of human activities, etc., etc. I think we know that type of rhetoric and where it goes. Section 29 talks about sustainable global development requires that those who are more affluent adopt lifestyles within the planet's ecological means in their use of energy, for example. Further, rapidly growing populations can increase the pressure on resources and slow any rise in living standards. Thus, sustainable development can only be pursued if population size and growth are in harmony with the changing productive potential of the ecosystem. And Section 30, yet in the end, sustainable development is not a fixed state of harmony, but rather a process of change in which the exploitation of resources, the direction of investments, the orientation of technological development, and institutional change are made consistent with future as well as present needs. We do not pretend that the process is easy or straightforward. Painful choices have to be made. Thus, in the final analysis, sustainable development must rest on political will. Yes, that is Dr. Gru Harlem Brundtland, and more importantly, the Brundtland Report, Our Common Humanity, that resulted from her commission back in 1987 to look at the problems humanity was facing and how we can possibly deal with it. Oh, by implementing sustainable development, which, as we all know by now, or you should know by now, is nothing other than a fig leaf that has been used to cover over the quest for the monopolization of the world and all of its resources, including its human resources, in the name of sustainable development, saving Mother Earth, whatever will work for the plebs to lap this up. So, yes, if you want the longer story and more details on that, I highly suggest you check into episode 322 on what is sustainable development. Easy for me to say. But let's just put this on the record. Dr. Gru Harlem Brundtland is one of those names that we should know. This should be a household name for people who are, well, I suppose globalists, or who are opposed to the globalists, to know, to understand the history of where this comes from, what key figures and names and dates and milestones have taken place along the path towards this globalist monstrosity that is being constructed around us. Dr. Gru Harlem Brundtland is one of those names that we should know. So here's some more information from Dr. Nass's slide. But let's move on to the next slide on the 1992 Rio Earth Summit. This is presumably a summit that is in the living memory of most of the people who are watching this report right now. I certainly remember all of the hoopla and globalist propaganda that was surrounding the 1992 Rio Earth Summit back when it took place. And in case you happen to miss it, yes, this is a highly venerated, highly important part of that path towards global government that continues to resonate with globalists to this day. Hopefully, maybe, you might remember Corbett Report Radio number 161, which aired back in June of 2012, where I covered the Rio Plus 20 conference. Yeah, that's right. They had a big 20th anniversary celebration to renew and revivify the goals that were set out at the Rio conference. What happened at the Rio conference? Oh, just some things like the formation of the UNFCCC, and of course the IPCC, which operates under it, which, if you don't know about, I would highly suggest you check into Questions for Corbett episode 96 on Is the IPCC Rigged? Spoiler, yes it is, but if you want to know about the history of those organizations, where they come from, how they were rigged, that the people that were behind that rigging, and how it operates to this day, I really suggest you check out this important episode of Questions for Corbett. There's a lot of information jam-packed into that. But as I say, the Rio Earth Summit did not just bestow this UNFCC monstrosity on the world. It also brought us the Convention on Biological Diversity, the CBD. And if you just hear about the name or just hear the little synopsis of it, it sounds like mother's milk. It's wonderful. The conservation of biological diversity, the sustainable use of its components, and the fair and equitable sharing of benefits arising out of the use of genetic resources? Even the term genetic resources should be enough to send a shiver down your spine. But anyway, yes, the Convention on Biological Diversity. You're for biological diversity, aren't you? What could go wrong? And anyway, there's more information on that. And oh, a little other thing that was birthed at Rio back in 1992. Agenda 21. Maybe you've heard of it. Anyway, yes, speaking of the Convention on Biological Diversity, as Dr. Nass points out, it's been worked on and updated and expanded since it was originally launched in 1992. In fact, the CBD has its own COP, i.e. Conference of the Parties. Now, hopefully, by this point, you're familiar with the UNFCCC's COP. Every year, they get together for their big globalist shindig to figure out what they're going to do next in the name of saving Mother Earth. Well, just as the UNFCCC has its Conference of the Parties, so does the Convention on Biological Diversity and every other major international convention. So, yes, every year they get together and see how they can expand the scope of what they're doing and take more control into their own hands. There's the Cartagena Protocol on Biosafety from 2003. There's the Nagoya Protocol on Access and Benefit Sharing from 2014. And as Dr. Nass points out and has completely escaped my radar, in August of 2024, the CBD, the latest COP, was working on a brand new wonderful thing, edging closer to operationalizing an agreement on the fair and equitable sharing of benefits from the use of digital sequence information on genetic resources. Yes, that's right. They've updated this genetic resources idea to the 21st century, and now it's, of course, digital sequence information about genetic resources. What are they talking about? Well, of course, they're talking about their repository of information on bioweapons, and of course, what will ultimately feed into the 100-day vaccines, which are now becoming normalized in the public imagination, of they're going to take some digital constructed sequence of genetic material and they're going to construct an mRNA vaccine or a self-amplifying mRNA vaccine that will operate to produce whatever protein is needed to save you from the scourge of whatever it is they're cooking up in their laboratories, etc., etc. We know that narrative by now, but by the way, yeah, they're still continuing to work this out and still continuing to put out things like this, continuing to hammer on the Convention on Biological Diversity to expand its scope and what is covered underneath it to include digital sequence information on genetic resources. What could go right? Anyway, more information on that here in this presentation, but it didn't stop in Rio, unfortunately. 1992 wasn't the last signpost along the way. We had the Millennium Development Goals, which were a result of the UN Millennium Declaration 2000. Do you remember that? The Millennium Development Goals? Maybe not, because they weren't hyped as much as, say, Agenda 21 or the latest iteration of these goals. But yes, around the year 2000, when they realized their Agenda 21 wasn't quite on track, they came out with this interim, well, we need some Millennium Development Goals to eradicate poverty and to help women and reduce child mortality and whatever else, whatever sounds good. And hey, we lifted 800 million people out of poverty. Well, who did? The Chi-Coms? Must have been through just caring and loving their people so much. Anyway, don't think about the details. Just trust us. And of course, the Millennium Development Goals were really just a stepping stone towards the Sustainable Development Goals and the Agenda 2030. So, again, you know about this by now, presumably, and if you don't, well, you definitely have some catching up to do, and you might want to start at the years and years of coverage that I've given it, along with James Evan Pilato at Media Monarchy, as, for example, we've been covering the Sustainable Development Goals since their very inception back in 2015. We had an episode of New World Next Week on UN Rolls Out Agenda 2030 Globalist Goals to introduce those goals to the audience in case they needed that introduction. And yes, the SDGs are also an urgent call to shift the world onto a more sustainable path. The SDGs are a bold commitment to finish what we started. That sounds like a threat more than a promise, but I'll let you come to your own conclusion on that. And of course, it didn't stop there. They pressed ahead with the Paris Climate Agreement, which is, again, for people who haven't been paying attention, more pseudoscientific gobbledygook, promising to use the magical thermostat that precisely puts temperature to within a tenth of a degree Celsius. They're going to use that thermostat to dial in a temperature rise from pre-industrial levels of no more than 2 degrees Celsius. Now, there's a million ways you could deconstruct that, scientifically speaking, to show that it is rubbish, but who cares about those details? The point, of course, is in the networks of surveillance and other things that will have to be built in order to make sure countries are on target with their emissions cuts and everything. And, of course, the big climate trough, the trillions of dollars in investable capital and others that are being sloshed around as the carrot and the stick in this giant system of control that's being brought into place that, oh, by the way, just happens to function exactly in the exact fashion that technocracy was always meant to function, by delimiting the resources of the economy not in dollars or other arbitrary units of exchange, but in units of energy. And pretty soon we're going to have not just the carbon trackers, and it won't be voluntary, it'll be carbon rationing. And that will be the basis of the economy. You heard it here first. All right. But it doesn't stop there. Yes, the CBD, the Convention on Biological Diversity, had a 2022 update at their COP15. Which, again, this particular statement, I think I did see it at the time, but I didn't latch onto it as I should have. Yes, they threatened back in 2022 that by 2030, they are going to have management of at least 30% of the world's lands, inland waters, coastal areas, and oceans. Now again, this could be the type of rhetoric that just washes over you. It's just the same globalese mealy-mouth nonsense that you've heard a million times before. But no, really cogitate about what they are laying out here in black and white on their own press release for COP15, nations adopt 4 goals, 23 targets for 2030 in landmark UN biodiversity agreement. This landmark agreement puts in black and white their goal, their vow, their threat to take management of at least 30% of the world's lands, inland waters, coastal areas, and oceans, i.e. 30% of the globe, by the year 2030. And that's just the start. I mean, what happens after 2030? But really, think about that. Yes, 30% of everything on the planet, they are going to have under management by the year 2030. And what does that management look like? What does it entail for an amorphous international convention like the CBD? What is that? Well, it sounds like global government to me, or global governance. Global government? No, global governance is totally different. Don't worry, guys. Yeah, so they are, again, not shy of putting this in black and white for us to read. So thank you to Dr. Nass for dredging that up. As I say, I think I've heard this before, but I didn't really catch on to what they were saying and the importance of that. Yes, they are vowing, threatening to take control of one-third of the planet by 2030. At least that's what they want. Whether or not they will get it might be a different matter. Here's another thing that Dr. Ness drew my attention to. I don't think I've even heard of this before. Natura 2000. Natura 2000? A network of protected areas covering Europe's most valuable and threatened species and habitats. The largest coordinated network of protected areas in the world. Again, it starts and sounds like a beautiful thing to preserve and conserve nature. But what's it really about? And look at the map and what it shows. So it might surprise you if you follow some of these links that Dr. Ness has kindly provided to some more information about this organization and what it's up to, that it started life as so many of these things do. Don't worry, we're not taking over the planet. This is a birds directive. That's right, in 1979, the birds directive established an EU-wide protection regime for all bird species naturally occurring in the EU. See, guys, it's just about protecting birds. And you want to... Who is against the bird? I mean, are birds real? But really, who is against the birds, right? But, of course, the approach was extended through the 1992 Habitats Directive, which also provided for the establishment of a representative system of legally protected areas throughout the EU. And yes, throughout the EU is the right term there. Again, look at the map and look at all of these habitats, legally protected areas that have grown out of this birds directive, lo those many decades ago. And that's how so many of these things start, as small initiatives with extremely tight focus and scope that sound utterly, utterly innocuous to the point where no one would even think to protest them? Warn about them? Who cares? It's a birds directive. Oh, now it's this. And what will it be by the year 2030? Well, anyway, once again, thank you to Dr. Ness for dredging this up. These are the names, the dates, the facts, the figures, the organizations, the treaties, the conventions, the agreements, the conferences that are constantly being worked on and updated. And if we do not know them, we will not be able to even see these types of things coming, let alone adequately respond to them. Because yes, again, how many people even know about the Natura 2000 network or how it developed out of the Birds Directive? But here it is in black and white. And ultimately, of course, that leads us to the doorstep of the latest iteration of this. Again, you should know this from episode 465 of the Corbett Report podcast on the Summit of the Future. Well, of course, we just had that just last month. They're descending on New York to sign on the dotted line of the Pact for the Future. And if you are unaware of that, well, once again, you have some catching up to do, but once again, don't worry, I've provided that in a couple of things. Not only episode 465 of the podcast on the UN's Death Pact for the Globalist Future, but also, as I talked about at the end of that podcast episode, I translated the Pact for the Future from the Globalese, and so provided you with plain English as to what that pact is really about and what it's threatening to do. Anyway, this is just one example of a tight 15-minute presentation that opens up this Pandora's box of all these names and dates and figures and facts and documents that it can be a lot to put your head around, but there are a couple of things that are worth noting. One of which, as I think, as Dr. Ness points out towards the end of that, hey, look, I don't know while I'm still learning all of this stuff. I assume everyone's out there on their own learning path. We need to continue digging up and understanding this agenda so that we can effectively counteract that. I'm 100% on board with that. Another important thing to recognize about this is a point I keep going back to. This isn't some hidden agenda. This isn't some secret conspiracy. This is out in the open. They talk about it. They put it in black and white. 30% of the world's lands and coastal areas and oceans and waterways by the year 2030, or etc. And if you want some of that etc., I recently wrote an editorial on Planetary Regime, the Globalist's Blueprint in Their Own Words, in which I go through numerous examples of specific statements about the coming world government and how it's going to be set up and who's going to be affected by it and in what way, etc., etc. So there's another resource to add to the list. There is a lot to go through, but as I say, I think it behooves us to go through it and to understand this. So if you're interested in naming names and connecting dots, well, I'm glad you're here because that's what this is about. And if you want more information on this, of course, CorbettReport.com/naming Names is where you can go for the show notes with all of the links to all of the various documents, etc., that you've heard today, and a link to download the PDF version of Meryl Ness's presentation so you can go through slide by slide and see the links that she had there as well. So lots of information, and I certainly hope that you've gotten something out of it, but I want to leave you on the note that Dr. Ness opened her presentation with, because I think it's extremely important. As she pointed out at the very, very beginning of her talk, this is a struggle between the people of the world, the billions of people on this planet who just want to go about living their lives, and the small group of elitists who think that they should own this planet and its resources, including its human resources. That is you and me. And we should, at the very least, be aware of this agenda, be able to name the names behind it, be able to cite the documents, and most importantly of all, declare our sovereignty to their faces when and if possible. You do not own us. We are not yours. We are not beholden to you. We do not participate in your phony schemes. We are not part of your global agenda. We do not concede our sovereignty, and we do not abide by your technocratic schemes. And I think it is important to declare that, not only to the they, them, those, not only to the people around you, but to yourself, to remember that you are an individual sovereign human being and that you are not subject to these international agreements that you did not sign up to. Anyway, as I say, a lot of information to go through. I hope the show notes will be useful for you. Thank you to Dr. Ness for the presentation, and that's going to do it for today's exploration, but I hope you'll be back in the future as I continue naming names and connecting dots in this ongoing exploration that we are conducting here together, you and me here at the Corbett Report. I hope you'll be there to join me for that in the future, but that'll do it for today. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, thanking you for joining me and asking you to join me again next time.